Yes, thank you very much. So, as I understand it, the point of these talks is to explain, you know, to be general in any of the Blackboard lunch talks, but also these ones at the beginning of the year are supposed to help explain the purpose and nature of the programs, especially to people outside of the program. So, naturally, of course, most of the people here are inside my program. That's just how it works. Those are the ones who come to the talk. So none of you will learn anything if I do my job correctly, because if I start talking about things you don't know, I've gone way beyond what I should be saying. So I won't be insulted if you start reading papers or sending text messages or whatever you like. You can go ahead. The difficult thing is no one wanted to give this talk. I was tricked into it. Because everyone's saying, oh, it's so hard, there's no, you know, overarching structure to our program, we really don't know what to say. And I was saying, oh, no, come on, it wouldn't be that hard. Safe in the knowledge that I was scheduled to be away during the time when it was scheduled to be given, but I had miscalculated my calendar, so I talked myself into this without really wanting to. But I've developed a strategy for giving the talk, which is that I believe it'll be the case that there'll be at least two talks by members of the program, two of these, is that right? Two of these Blackboard lunch talks. So my talk will only ask questions. I will not provide any answers. And the next talk will give you all the answers, which I don't yet know. So string theory and cosmology is the focus of our program. And it was always a little unclear to the organizers or to anyone else what that meant, string theory and cosmology. But I think even so far, it's been a great success. In fact, I would go so far as to say, I'm probably too young to make this claim, but I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, that of all the string theory get-togethers of any sort over the last 30 years or so, this has been the one most interested, most recent one, and the one most constrained by data. The one that tried to explain observations of the world the most. So whether or not it's been a success in explaining those observations remains to be for history to decide, but at least, you know, it is a meeting. There's an event. Something happens. Okay, that's good. So but still, we're pretty vague about what things mean. So the organization of my talk will reflect the lack of, let's say, a standard model of string theory and cosmology. The organization is, first I will talk about string theory, and then I will talk about cosmology. And then I will put them together. So much as they can be put together. Okay. So first, what is string theory? And it should tell you all you need to know, that we don't know what string theory is. This is a question that we try to answer. We're not even sure what the theory is yet. Of course, to give you an introduction to string theory, I'm certainly not in the top 50 percentile of people in the room who are qualified to do this, which just goes to show that I'm not that smart to be up here giving the talk. But already the fact that I was an organizer shows you that I couldn't be all that smart to get you into these things. But the miracle is, semi-outsider, that eventually as you study string theory and learn what they're talking about, you realize that it really is just the theory of strings. I mean, you don't kind of believe that when you're first told it. I mean, there's got to be something more profound to it. But this is sort of the miracle of string theory, that you just say, what would be the quantum theory of relativistic strings? And you start there, and you're led down a path. And this is what makes string theory sort of different from other approaches, for example, to quantum gravity. The reason why we're interested in it is not just because we like strings intrinsically, but because string theory provides us with a quantum theory of gravity, it seems, and perhaps a theory of everything, and you've heard all the grandiose claims. But the starting point really is just, what would happen if we quantized a relativistic string? That's what makes it different from other approaches to quantum gravity, because there's plenty of things you could do to try to quantize gravity. You could say, well, maybe space-time is discrete. Maybe we should triangulate space-time and sum over a set of simplices. Maybe we should just do some very clever, non-perturbative quantization of general relativity itself. And all these things are tried, but generally they get stuck. I mean, you start doing it, and you're not quite sure what to do next. You make some guesses, and they don't really seem to go. With string theory, you just say to yourself, well, let's imagine there's a little loop of string. I'll talk about closed strings just because it's easier, a little circle. And let's quantize it. Let's make it relativistic. Let's quantize. Let's see what happens. And everything flows from that, including the fact that gravity has to exist. And that was sort of one of the major miracles of string theory. But a lot of other things flow from it also. You don't get stuck. You're led to things whether you like them or not. And it's actually quite... I don't want to say predictive exactly, but it's kind of, it's restricted in a very real way. Okay, so what does it mean a relativistic string? I should be clear about that. The thing you're not allowed to ask is what is the string made of? For some reason, when people talk about string theory, they always want to know what is the string made of, and that's, no one ever asks what is the electron made of, it's an electron, okay? What is string made of? It's made of whatever strings are made of. This is supposed to be the point at which you're not allowed to ask anymore. Everything else is made of strings. This is the starting point. The unmoved mover is this little relativistic string. By relativistic, we mean that it's basically a Lorentz invariant string. So if you have a piece of string that you would tie your boat to the dock with, there is a rest frame for that string. If you hold on to the string, you know whether it's standing still or whether it's moving, because your hand would burn if it were moving. A relativistic string is Lorentz invariant, which means that there's no rest frame to it. You can boost and move along the string, and the tension and the energy density in the string are such that you couldn't tell the difference how fast the string is moving past you. That's all it means to be relativistic. Okay? So take that, make it into a little loop. Ask what could the action, what could the theory defining that be? And Nambu said, well, maybe area swept out by the world sheet of the string, by this one-dimensional string propagating through time. And there's more sophisticated versions of that action now. But basically, by trying to make this work, you're led to a whole bunch of different things. For instance, what are you led to? You're led to gravity, which is interesting. And you can actually understand why you're led to gravity, which is an amazing thing that they rarely tell you. This is an enlarged view of what the string actually looks like. Okay. The real strings in string theory are very small. They're like the Planck scale, which is very small, 10 to the minus 40 some centimeters, if I remember correctly. So 33 centimeters, I'm thinking of the Planck time, 10 to the minus 40 some seconds. Okay, so it's bigger than I thought, but it's still very small. And it's small enough that if you shrink this down, what would a little loop of string look like if it were very small? It would look like a particle. Okay, that's why we see particles in nature, if you believe string theory, because the strings are too small to be resolved by our current instruments. And we have different kinds of particles in nature, and they're characterized by their mass, their spin, their charge, and so forth. So the strings must be able to reproduce kinds of particles with different masses, different spins, and different charges. And it turns out that the way that strings reproduce all of those features is just through how they wiggle. Nothing more than that. It's a string, it wiggles in different ways, it vibrates, if you like, and the way in which it's vibrating, sort of the directions in which it's vibrating, tell you what kind of particle it is that you would be observing. Now, I'm not going to go through and derive the spectrum of the standard model from looking at the vibrations of the string, but in principle, that's what one would hope to do. However, you can just think about what are sort of the lowest lying modes of the string. What are the simplest ways that a string could wiggle, that a string could vibrate? And these should give you the least energetic particles that you observe. In other words, the lowest mass particles, in fact, the massless kinds of particles. So what are the fundamental vibrational modes of a string? Well, you can have a loop of string that sort of gets bigger and smaller, right? So it has a breathing mode. It starts as a string, gets bigger, and it gets smaller, and it gets bigger and smaller again. That's one possible thing that the string can do. Another thing it can do is keep the same size, but oscillate, like into an ellipse, back and forth, like that. So there's another mode where the string stretches in one direction and shrinks in the other. Something like that. And then backwards. So it oscillates to an ellipse like that. So it goes in a plus sign configuration. That's a very low energy mode of a vibrating string. And finally, there's another one which does the same thing but is linearly independent because it's tilted. So in an X sign configuration rather than a plus sign configuration, a string could vibrate like this, into an ellipse tilted that way, and then bounce back into an ellipse tilted that way. And that's basically it. Those are the lowest fundamental modes of a vibrating string. It turns out that, you know, if you quantize a system and ask, what does it lead to? Well, the spin of the system is what is characterized by how many degrees you need to rotate it into to get back where you started. And it turns out that for this, you can rotate this little string, and it's already into itself. So that would turn into a spin zero particle. Whereas this guy, the oscillating string in a plus sign or a cross sign, those of you who are familiar with gravitational radiation know that if you just take classical general relativity, and you have a set of particles, and a gravitational wave passes by, if you had arranged those particles in a circle, the gravitational wave would make them oscillate in either a plus sign, if it's one polarization of the gravitational wave, or an X, if it's the other polarization of a gravitational wave. That is the signal that this guy is a spin 2 particle when you quantize it, and it's a massless spin 2 particle. And it turns out that massless spin 2 particles give you gravity. Classically, that's what you'd expect, just from looking at small perturbations of Einstein's equation. This is what gravitational waves do. They move things in this kind of polarization. So what you'd expect that string theory gives you in the massless sector is a spin 0 particle and 2 polarization modes of a massless spin 2 particle. So that's like gravity, but sadly it's like scalar tensor gravity. It's like a modified version of Einstein's equations, where there's some massive massless scalar field lying around. Fortunately, it's easy to give masses to scalar fields. It's hard to give masses to spin 2 fields. So it's not surprising that we have never observed this guy. If you started with this massless spectrum and did all sorts of messy things to it, you would expect at the end of the day to observe some massless spin 2 particle, and that is what we observe in nature. That's gravity. So the point is, strings have to give rise to gravity because that's how they oscillate. And this is what annoyed people when they were doing string theory in the early days. They didn't want gravity. They were trying to explain the strong interactions. And if you went to Gabriel Veneziano's colloquium last week, you know they certainly did not start by saying what would happen if you quantized a relativistic string. They started by thinking about the strong interactions and how to explain them phenomenologically, and they were led to strings. They sort of gave up when they realized they kept predicting gravity until someone said, well, maybe that's good to predict gravity because gravity exists. And they increased the tension of the string, and voila, the theory of everything was born. So you get gravity whether you like it or not out of string theory. That's one of the reasons why people like it so much. You get other things as well. You get supersymmetry. Well, no, I shouldn't say that yet. You get first extra dimensions of space. So you have a string, it's oscillating. You say, I quantize that thing. When is it consistent? It turns out that that oscillating relativistic string is only consistent in certain numbers of space-time dimensions. All by itself, if I just did that, it's consistent in something like 26 space-time dimensions. The problem with that is that it's consistent in 26 dimensions, but it's unstable. There's no simple-minded, stable vacuum state to that theory. Fortunately, nature gives us a little clue and says that we don't just have bosons in the world, we also have fermions. So if you allow this string to vibrate in not just bosonic directions of space, but fermionic directions of space, you find that you need 10 dimensions of space-time. And that's why string theory predicts extra dimensions. It would have been nicer if it had predicted 4, but 10 is good because it's at least more than 4, and you can imagine that some of them are really tiny, you don't see them. Had it predicted only 2 or 3, we would be in more trouble than we're in already. Yes, in different histories, they're always dumber than we are. Okay, and then it predicts supersymmetry because that version of the theory, the 10-dimensional fermionic string theory, has a symmetry between the bosons and fermions in it, which is, in fact, supersymmetry. This is how supersymmetry was discovered historically in the context of trying to do this two-dimensional thing because the world needs two-dimensional. Yeah, I'm glossing over a whole bunch of things. So if you are clever, which there are string theorists who are clever, you can get rid of almost all of these features. I mean, you can really work hard. However, what I mean when it says string theory predicts these things is really just that if you're not clever, you would easily, even if you're not clever, you would easily be led to coming up to these things. And then you can think of ways around them, ways to get rid of supersymmetry, ways to change the numbers of dimensions and so forth. All of that is possible. But the most simple-minded following of your nose leads you to these things. I think that's fair. I'm willing to be wrong.
So far you didn't introduce any constants.
No.
To the string.
That's right. Secretly. There's an energy density per unit length of the string. That's the one constant. That's the one dimensionful constant, yes. Everything else is a dimensionless number.
Sorry?
Pardon?
That just set the scale.
Right. So if there's only one constant, there are no constants, if that makes sense, right?
Dimensionable constants, yes.
And finally, I don't know if we can read this. Wait, at the bottom here, I'm just going to write higher dimensional objects are also predicted. Not finally, there are other things as well. And these are what string theorists call brains, as a generalization of membrane to be a two-dimensional object. So you hear about string theory not being a theory of strings. What you mean is you start with the theory of strings, you end up predicting things that are more than one-dimensional, things that are two-dimensional, three-dimensional, and larger, that the strings can interact with. And then you realize you should have included them in your theory in the first place. But the point is, you don't have a choice. You can't say, well, I want to consider with brains or with a two-dimensional brain and a three-dimensional brain, but nothing else. You're led to what brains are there in individual realization of string theory. So it's kind of predictive in that sense. So this is the good news. This is why string theory is far and away the leading candidate to be a theory of everything. First, it is a theory of quantum gravity. And people who are not doing quantum gravity worry about, you know, experiments, that we can't really get direct experimental evidence pertaining to quantum gravity. And of course, it would be great if you had detailed experimental evidence. But you have lots of non-detailed experimental evidence because you have gravity and you have quantum mechanics. And you want a theory that gives you both of those. If you had two theories that gave you both of those, you might want some more detailed experimental evidence to try to choose between them. But while you're still looking for one, we have at least enough data to tell us that we are not finished yet, that we need something better. And string theory is far and away the best candidate for being a correct quantum theory and a theory that predicts gravity. It also predicts all these other things. Gauge symmetries are another thing that it predicts, and these things are reflected in the world that we see. If we discovered supersymmetry, that would be another bonus, another indication that we're on the right track. Yes?
Whatever you put that, maybe you were going to do it afterwards, but the reason why it is a good theory of quantum gravity, which is related to the presence of a scale, of an energy scale.
Why don't you say that, since I don't know what you're talking about.
Sorry. I mean, as you said correctly, if you reproduce gravity, low energy.
Right.
But you don't fall into the same problem as if you were trying to quantize standard gravity.
Right, okay.
Gravity is modified at sufficiently high energy so that the theory is equalized in time.
That's right. So this tiny little string looks like a particle if you're very, very far away from it. You don't have very high resolution. And therefore, you get ordinary gravity at what we consider long distances, long wavelengths, low energies. But of course, once you get up to high energies where you can resolve the structure of the string, you get a theory that would be different than if you were just naively quantizing ordinary general relativity. That's good because naively quantizing ordinary general relativity doesn't work, as far as anybody knows. So the fact that the theory does change its character once you begin to resolve the stringiness of it all is a feature, not a bug. And that's what makes it work, basically. I think that's what you're trying to say. Were there any other questions about what string theory is? Okay, so, but it's not all peaches and cream. There are issues that we don't know the answer to. So there are some issues in string theory, as much as we hate to admit it. And so I'm going to group the issues into two parts. First, what is the theory? And second, what are the solutions? But besides that, we're in great shape. So, we have, and people will correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong about this, but this, I think I can say this. There is no complete, non-perturbative, this is very dangerous, background independent. Aha, you see, you were ready to pounce, weren't you? Formulation of the theory.
That sounds like
you're going to argue with that?
Formulation.
What background
independent? You mean that you can't handle the higher energy excitations?
No, we have complete non-perturbative background-dependent formulations. We also have perturbative background-independent formulations. So we can do a lot. But I don't think that we have.
Well,
I don't know the right definition. That's why I was avoiding that. But it means, for example, with a certain set of asymptotic boundary conditions on your spacetime. If you fix boundary conditions at infinity, then we have what we think are complete and non-perturbative formulations of string theory. Right. Okay. So let me say I was actually going to say this. So I was going to say something like this. It is possible that there is no such thing as a complete non-perturbative background independent formulation of the theory. It could be that complete non-perturbative formulations of string theory are like coordinates on a topologically complicated manifold, that there are patches, there are regions where you use one coordinate system, there's another patch where you need another coordinate system, and hopefully they overlap in some region you understand, but there is no global once-and-for-all formulation that you could write down. So maybe this is an issue, that's why it's an issue, not a problem, but it's an issue. We would like to know what string theory looks like in all sorts of circumstances. I think that's fair, right? Even Gary would agree, yes? You're agreeing with me?
I was only going to quibble that often by background dependence, people mean specifying a space-time metric everywhere.
Okay.
Background dependent, you need a flat metric everywhere, or you need an ADS metric everywhere, something like that. And that's certainly not the case in our current understanding.
No, that's right. It's only asymptotic
boundary conditions. And I mean, I don't know, people for a long time in quantum gravity have distinguished between asymptotically flat space-times and their quantization and compact cosmological space-times and their quantization. And it seems like a pretty weak requirement to specify.
Yeah, okay. So for those of you not in the program, all of our string theory friends are saying maybe we don't want this or need it, which is very possible. We would still certainly like to understand better all various formulations that we do have of string theory and how they fit together. I mean, we would like to maybe know all of them if there's some classification or something like that.
I mean, if you take out background independent, why you say we do have a complete non-perturbative understanding?
Well, complete might be, I didn't actually say those words ever, but we have a non-perturbative understanding. We have a perturbative understanding.
Perturbative.
I think the real reason you want the background independent is that there is no formulation which addresses the background we want to understand.
So that would be another point of view that let's not get into this for our friends who are not string theorists. They could, you know, these guys could talk about this forever, let me tell you. Okay, and so what is the space of solutions we're not really sure of? Of course, that's asking a lot, the entire space of all the solutions. So let's give them a fighting chance, and we would even just like to know what the vacuum solutions are. Something that looks like empty space, in some sense. So we know in string theory some versions of empty space, but not others. So we have a ways to go there. We'd like to understand even more than that, of course. There's non-empty spaces that you would like to understand. But let's, you know, first try to understand empty space. So there is a picture, there's an idea for what the space of vacuum solutions might look like. And I'll tell you the idea. The idea may or may not be right. The idea is that the simple classification of vacuum solutions is into supersymmetric states and non-supersymmetric states. So the theory that we're starting with, we're imagining there's some underlying supersymmetry in the theory. That even is not true in some versions, but let's imagine that there is. But then that's different than the actual state being supersymmetric. Just like any time you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, you can have a state which does not respect the theory, does not respect the symmetries of the underlying theory. So now let's actually consider states which are supersymmetric. And we believe that there is a space of supersymmetric solutions to string theory. And in fact, there's a multidimensional family of such solutions that are connected by values of different parameters and that are smoothly connected to each other. And so basically in this space, you would observe some massless scalar fields that are characterizing the values of these different parameters that are telling you which supersymmetric vacuum solution you are in. Typically in quantum field theory, it's hard to get massless scalar fields. You can get them if you have some exact global symmetry, which is spontaneously broken. Here you don't have any symmetry. There's no symmetry relating the different supersymmetric vacuum states, but there are scalar fields whose expectation value tell you which ones you're in, and the reason why they're kept massless is just because of supersymmetry. It's not that you move along supersymmetric directions, but just that supersymmetry is so constraining that you can't give any masses to these fields. So there's a set of supersymmetric vacua, which is some space. In fact, they call it moduli space because these scalar fields can be thought of as moduli of something or another, depending on where you are. There might even be regions where it's not easily describable in terms of scalar fields, but the point is there is a smooth family, or at least a multidimensional family, of supersymmetric vacuum solutions to string theory. That's disappointing. It's bad news, because in the early go-go junk bond days of string theory, you could have thought that there was only one vacuum solution and we lived in it. You can't think that anymore because we don't live in 10-dimensional flat Minkowski space, highly supersymmetric, and everyone now believes is a solution to string theory.
Or
okay? Or that's another.
Which is negative energy. So it is either negative or vanishing.
That's right. So none of these vacuum states have a positive cosmological constant, which we'll get to when we start talking about cosmology. So we certainly don't live in any of these states. Maybe, hopefully, there are non-supersymmetric vacuum-like solutions to string theory, and this is an active area of research right now. Because you've broken supersymmetry in these, there's no reason to have connected sets of them. They probably just come in a discrete set of points. So here are a discrete set of points that I'm sort of drawing as hovering over the supersymmetric ones. So we think that perhaps there is a discrete set of non-supersymmetric vacuum-like states. In other words, if you lived in them, supersymmetry would be broken, but it would look like empty space. You'd have some value of the vacuum energy, but nothing else around. And very likely, these states are not stable. There can be some decay process in which the non-supersymmetric vacuum can decay into one of the supersymmetric ones or something like that. One way of thinking about this is you might have some scalar field lying around, which might have been one of the scalar fields telling you where you lived in this space, to which you've given a potential. And the potential looks something like this. So you live here in some metastable vacuum state. And then if you pop over by tunneling or some thermal process or something like that, you can run off to phi equals infinity and you land back in the supersymmetric vacuum state. So we might very well live in one of these little dots up here. It looks like, you know, some landscape with bad weather or something like that, and we live in one of the clouds. And someday we will nucleate and rain down into supersymmetry. Hopefully, that will take much longer than the age of the universe and won't happen, you know, tomorrow or before the end of this talk or something like that.
I'm not sure why one assumes that such a state would decay to a supersymmetric one. If you have a broken magnetic symmetry for a magnetic ground state, it won't decay into a non-magnetic.
I don't want to assume that it necessarily will. I said that's a real possibility. We know that these solutions do exist, and there is very good reason to believe that they're all of lower energy than this. It is true that you might be able to tie your boundary conditions somehow to prevent that decay from happening, but so you should start writing papers about this, not ask me questions about it.
What do you have in mind in terms of?
I don't have anything in mind, no.
This is a generic feature if you have a positive cosmological constant and extra dimensions.
The existence of this runaway, I mean, this is one of the earliest results in the 80s about, not earliest results of string theory, but a fundamental early result is that you can always run off to some supersymmetric vacuum. It could be that your potential looks like this, in which case you would just get stuck, and you would not necessarily be.
What you plotted, again, from the other side perspective, looks like alpha decay.
Yeah,
so you have,
that's right.
On the other side, a continuum of possible vacua that you can tunnel into,
well,
or you have a discrete one, so you have exclusion principle, alpha decay.
No, well, there is a discrete, there's a continuum of states which are not quite vacua. So you never hit zero and stop. This asymptotes to infinity in a certain set of variables. So you can decay, and then you roll. That's right. And once you're there, of course, you can decay to different spots here. But if you land there, and you land there uniformly all over space, you would stick there. You wouldn't move. So any questions about that picture of our current understanding of string theory, such as it is. That threw that remarkably unscathed. I'm very happy. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about cosmology then, which is a complete change of gears here. String theory, we understand a lot, but we know nothing. Cosmology, we know a lot, but we understand nothing. So there's a lot of complementarity here. So what do we know? We know a lot. I mean, so that's the literal statement. We've learned a lot by observing the universe. We know a lot about it. We don't understand why it is that way. We're trying to figure that out. So what do we know about the universe? Cosmology is the study of everything that is larger than either larger than a supercluster of galaxies or smaller than a proton. That's what counts. Everything else is for the other program, as far as I'm concerned. So, what do we know about the universe? The universe is pretty much the same everywhere. Remember, if it's smaller than a supercluster of galaxies, I don't care. So that doesn't count. The fact that this room is different than outside doesn't count.
You mean the observable part of the universe?
That's right. So this is the observable part of the universe. Yes, I will emphasize that pretty soon, actually. You look over very large scales, over the observable universe, the number density of galaxies, the energy density, the behavior, the temperature, and so forth, looks pretty much the same. It's getting bigger, though. It's not the same as a function of time. It's expanding. So this was first discovered by an alumnus of the University of Chicago, Edwin Hubble, that the velocity of distant galaxies is proportional to their distance, v equals h times d. He was a point guard the last time the University of Chicago won the national basketball championship, which was in 1909. but we're still optimistic for future years. So what this means is that if you look at a distant galaxy, it appears to be moving away from you in the sense that the light coming from it is redshifted, and the further away it is, the more redshifted it looks like. Okay? The individual galaxies are not getting bigger. You are not getting bigger, or if you are, you can't blame the expansion of the universe. Not be held responsible. About 5% of the universe is ordinary matter. By ordinary matter, I mean every particle ever discovered. In the standard model of particle physics, all the protons, all the neutrons, all the photons and electrons and so forth, there's only 5% of the universe everywhere. By discovered, I don't mean we've actually seen all the 5% yet. I mean that type of particle only makes up 5% of the universe. 25% is something called dark matter. And in this sense that I'm using here of dark matter, I mean non-baryonic, non-ordinary dark matter, some new kind of particle which has never been observed in a particle accelerator, a very good reason to build more particle accelerators and go look for it. That leaves 70% of the universe, something we call dark energy, which is a very bad name for something which we know two things about. It is smoothly distributed through space and slowly varying, if at all, through time. In other words, it doesn't change very much from place to place in space-time. But it's there. It's 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter. It's not a lot of energy, but it's a big universe out there, and it builds up after a while, so it's 70% of everything there is. It might, for all we know, be exactly the same amount of energy density everywhere, in which case it is Einstein's cosmological constant, his greatest blunder, which is our brilliant discovery.
Just to make things more confusing, dark matter may also be made not from the particles. Like, for example, in the axion condensate oscillating, it's oscillating still.
Yeah, I would call that a particle, but okay, I know what you mean.
Coherent.
It can fall into a galaxy, it can clump, and you know, they have individual peculiar motions and so forth. It's not uniform. The dark matter is cold, it does not have large peculiar velocities, and it is concentrated in galaxies and clusters. That's what we know about it. As far as we know, it has no self-interactions, although that is a possibility.
A natural question that people might want to ask you to your last remark is that how slowly is it changing?
Really slowly.
In space, what's the upper bound?
What is the upper bound?
In space.
What units would you like me to use?
Appropriate.
It's less than 0.1 in appropriate units.
How the composition changes? temperatures? I mean, after the first 3 seconds,
yes,
the similar composition or the balance between,
yes,
changing faster or slower?
The ordinary matter and dark matter are both matter, and matter redshifts away its energy density at a fixed rate. So this ratio was supposed to be the same. Dark energy doesn't go away as the universe expands, while matter gets increasingly rarefied. So this is about 2 or 3 times as much as there is matter now. But when the microwave background was formed, for example, the amount of dark energy was 1/1,000,000,000 of the amount of matter. So their relative composition changes dramatically. We don't know why they're approximately equal today. That's an open question. One of the things we don't understand, although we know. It is a slightly perturbed universe in the sense that, as much as we don't like to admit it, there are slight variations in the energy density of the universe from place to place. So we could say that delta rho over rho, the change in energy density from place to place divided by the average energy density, primordially, early on, this is because we want to ignore the fact that the energy density evolves. And of course, today it's a much lumpier universe than it used to be in the past. So to fix things, we look at delta rho over rho primordial, and it's about 1 part in 10 to the 5. So it's 10 to the minus 5. A tiny little set of perturbations over a universe which is basically very smooth on very large scales. And this is, there's evidence for this, for example, in the temperature fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background, where delta T over T is about 10 to the minus 5. The cosmic microwave background is the leftover radiation from the early universe, which was opaque and thermalized into a black body. It became transparent when the universe was about 300,000 or 400,000 years old. We see a snapshot of the conditions in the universe when it was about 300,000 or 400,000 years old. It's now about 14 billion years old, so it's a long time ago.
And is that the period, that time, what you mean by primordially? After that 300,000?
Yeah, but any time earlier than that, delta rho is not really evolving very much. In the radiation-dominated era, when the universe was opaque, it wasn't evolving very much. So really, any time earlier than that would be a fine time to consider this number.
Is there equivalent, to Schwarzschild condition on mass, that if you have a radius that in certain mass, then you have to collapse to black hole?
No, because the universe is expanding. So that is not true. That idea that you have a certain amount of mass inside a certain radius, it has to collapse to a black hole, is not true if all of that mass is already moving apart from each other. No, because I could easily find a section of the universe in which the mass inside was much larger than the mass needed to create a Schwarzschild radius, much smaller than that, but nevertheless it doesn't fall into a black hole, it keeps expanding away. If you like, the early universe, or the universe, looks a lot like a time-reversed collapse into a black hole. So any solution to general relativity is also a time-reversed solution. You can collapse into a singularity in a black hole. The universe started in something that looks like a singularity and is expanding. Apart from that, why? I don't know. Maybe not even true. We don't know that there's really a singularity.
You say that it's reverse, and you don't have problems with the entropy.
We have huge problems with the entropy. What do you mean? That's right. The early universe had a really low entropy.
Right.
I don't know why.
Okay. Because it seems paradoxical that you had the.
I have ideas.
High entropy at the beginning, if you look at this picture.
If we took our universe today and we didn't know the detailed fine graining of where all the photons were moving in their trajectories and so forth, and we ran a condition like that backwards in time, there's no reason to think we'd get anything like what we think the actual early universe was like. And that's a problem. We don't know. I don't know. I have an idea. It's not the same as anybody else's idea, so I'm not going to tell you what it is. It's not the same as Andre's idea, for example. Andre's like vibrating. He wants to give us the correct answer.
In the simplest inflationary model, we may start with the domain with entropy 1, and then get our part of the universe with entropy 10 to the 88. And then, of course, it's completely an irreversible process. If you take all of these particles and push them back, you'll get only larger than 10 to the 88. But there is no problem.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think there is a problem there, but we could argue about that. I mean, degrees of freedom, it's hard to count how many degrees of freedom there are, for example, in a co-moving patch of the universe. But
degrees of freedom in the Planckian domain, I mean, you had the 10 to the 88 within this Planckian link?
Yeah, I don't know what I have. That's why I don't want to talk about it. Okay. But I think that there is an issue. I mean, it's one of these things where everyone is sure they know the answer, but no one's answer is the same as anyone else's answer. So that's a whole nother Blackboard talk. Okay. Yes.
You say that the perturbations are where they're minimized by, you have to distinguish though between the dark matter perturbations and the baryonic matter perturbations and the RAD lambda.
That's right. So this was delta rho over rho in matter in the universe, the ordinary and the dark, not in the dark energy, which has very little, if any, perturbations.
The dark matter, which is non-baryonic, so it's not interacting with photons, the perturbations.
Well, no, I think the primordial perturbations in the dark matter were of order 10 to the minus 5. The difference is that there was a moment in time, there was an era when the dark matter was evolving and the matter density was really not evolving very much. So they decoupled at that point. But asymptotically, as you go back and back and back, they had the same delta rho over rho. That just means that the perturbations were adiabatic, for which we have good evidence.
Why couldn't the dark energy also be slightly different?
Well, then we would detect it in clusters of galaxies and so forth.
No, it could be 10 to minus
5. Oh, well, it could be. It would then tend to show up in the CMB, and we haven't seen any evidence of it. So there's limits once again. You tell me exactly what kind of perturbations you want, I can tell you what the limits are. Mm-hmm. Phil could tell you what the limits are. I couldn't, actually. Okay, and finally, something we know about the universe is that it obeys Einstein's equations, or something very much like it, in a certain regime where we actually have data about what the universe does. And that regime is pretty big. It's between Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is the time that the early universe was a nuclear reactor. It was turning protons and neutrons into helium and deuterium and so forth. And we can see the abundances of helium and deuterium and so forth in our universe today. So this moment, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, is the earliest time in the universe's history about which we have empirical evidence. And the empirical evidence is that it really looks exactly like you would expect if the universe is made of what we think it's made of, and it obeys Einstein's equation. So Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so I should say, what Einstein's equation implies for cosmology is that the Hubble constant, this expansion rate, here, squared equals 8 pi g over 3 times that energy density rho, where g is Newton's constant. There's also a curvature term, which is probably very small, so I just won't put it there, but we could put it there. So this equation is true. This is the Friedman equation for nucleosynthesis, which has a time about 1 minute, and an energy scale, rho, is about an MeV, a million electron volts to the fourth power. So that's why Steven Weinberg's book about popular cosmology is called The First 3 Minutes, because that's the earliest time in the universe's history about which we have some information, nucleosynthesis, which happened at a time scale of seconds or minutes. Tony Z recently discovered that if you go to Amazon.com and look for the first 3 minutes, they say, you might also be interested in speed dating. 3 minutes. In 3 minutes, you can find the love of your life.
It's an organization that we introduce you to a different woman every 3 minutes.
We or man.
So Weinberg's book is.
We understand a lot more about the first 3 minutes of the universe than we do about how to find the love of your life. That is a different program, for which I will not be an organizer. Between nucleosynthesis and today. Today, today is about 13 billion years, and the energy density is about 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. So that's a lot, a great expanse of time and space where we understand the universe. Okay? And by that, I mean, of course, we don't understand everything. We don't understand how galaxies form. We don't understand cosmic rays. I understand there's stuff about, you know, patterns in biology we don't understand yet. But remember, under my constraints of what cosmologists study, we understand that part of the universe.
And that's the 5% or the 5%?
This is everything, total. So I know I use... Yeah, I mean, it's a little... This is the universal sign of cosmology, this little tilde sign here. This is matter. This is everything. It doesn't matter because they're the same order of magnitude, so who cares? But today, I mean, in the early universe, this is matter and, in fact, radiation also. Okay, so now that I'm running out of time, I perfectly timed this so that I get to talk about what nobody knows anything about. So now I can explain the title outside the box. The point is, we can draw a space-time diagram encompassing that part of the universe which we think we understand between Big Bang nucleosynthesis and today. So we have T equals zero, the Big Bang. We have, this is a space-time diagram. That means time goes up, space goes across. We have nucleosynthesis. So here is TBBN. And we have today. And what happens is, of course, that the universe expands. So if you have galaxies, they follow trajectories where they move away from each other as the universe expands. This is not a perfect diagram, of course, because at t equals zero, if you study general relativity, there's really a sense in which these are disconnected points, even though the volume of this slice is zero. The size of the universe is zero. The real reason, if you don't like that, then you just don't think about t equals zero, because we don't understand it. It's not really understandable in the context of classical general relativity. Okay? So think about t equals epsilon, and different world lines that evolve into galaxies really are separate, but they're separating more and more as the universe expands. So here we are today. You are there. And we can't see the whole universe, as Renata makes me say out loud, that we can't see the whole thing because we look at the universe with visible light or with light in other wavelengths, and light moves at a finite velocity called the speed of light. So you look backwards on light cones that look like this, and you can see what happens, see in the most broad sense of get some idea of what is happening by observing some sort of data as far back as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And the universe looks perfectly smooth at that point. It looks expanding. It looks like it obeys all of those conditions. We could even be optimistic and say that, you know, so we understand this section of the universe, what it was like at nucleosynthesis within our past light cone. Since we know what it's like then and we know something about the law of physics, we can imagine sort of evolving it up to today and imagining that we know what happens on our current moment of time within that co-moving box corresponding to the intersection of our past light cone with what happened during nucleosynthesis. So that's the box. Okay? This is the box that we think we understand. So what is the reason to intersect string theory with cosmology? Because starting from the box and going in any direction, there are things we don't understand that perhaps string theory could tell us something about. So remember, I'm just going to ask questions here. So let me ask some questions that string theory, that all this stuff that we know about string theory might have something to say about this outside of the box. So there's many directions in which we can move outside the box. For example, we can move down. Not quite all the way to the singularity, the very, very early universe, which set the initial conditions for what goes on in what we observe today. And so the leading candidate for initial condition setting processes is something called inflation. So the origin of the initial conditions. Inflation is a hypothesized period of expansion, accelerated expansion in the very, very early universe, which in very simple models can tell you why delta rho over rho is 10 to the minus 5, but otherwise the universe is pretty much the same everywhere. So that's a nice version of why the initial conditions might have looked like that. However, inflation happens at a very early time scale, most likely, when you're coming close to quantum gravity, number one. Number two, this imprinting of quantum fluctuations in an expanding universe onto the energy density is clearly a process that mixes up ideas of quantum mechanics and ideas of gravity, for which to really understand and have faith that you know what you're doing, you should have a quantum theory of gravity, for example, string theory. So if you really think that you want to understand inflation, believe it, and say that we know what it means, you should do it in context of a quantum theory of gravity such as string theory. So one of the projects that people would like to understand these days is how you can have inflation or something to replace inflation in the context of string theory. Let me continue to go in the same direction, but just further. You could go all the way down to the singularity.
Well, actually, one may argue that in order to study density perturbations, you do not really need quantum gravity. You need the theory of quantum fields on the constant, just time-dependent gravitational background, which is a
sure.
pair of quantized fields in an external field. That's it.
No, so there is an approximation, a semi-classical approximation, which we have every reason to believe should be good enough to understand how inflation works and how you get the density perturbations. However, I would think that until you actually know the theory to which it's an approximation, you can't really be guaranteed that your approximation is good. Probably it is. I, you know, have no strong belief that it's not good, but just to be safe, we would like to know the full theory, I would argue.
So, it's not true that you don't quantize the gravitational field. I mean, you have gravitational waves which are
Well, if you study,
you have to read the full quantum gravity. I agree with you.
Yeah. We're talking right now about the row over row. So for obtaining the row over row, you
don't just
need.
Get the row over row.
Yeah, right. So,
and you know that delta row over row couples to the fluctuation of the metric, so the gravitational field is quantized.
I also don't understand your last statement that why. So you cannot understand approximate theory unless you understand the theory to which it's
I didn't say you can't understand it. I said you can't be sure
you
were right. You
cannot be sure. Can you give me an example?
No. I mean, probably if I thought about it, I could, but I have not thought about it. I mean, there can always be subtle effects that you overlooked when you make approximations. And so if you don't know what theory you're approximating, mm-hmm. you don't know whether there's a subtle effect you might have overlooked as a very general philosophical principle. So number two is, what about this singularity? There is reason to believe that even if there is inflation, there is still a singularity of some sort prior to inflation. Those reasons are not airtight, but the reasons exist. And singularities might be something that happen in general relativity as an ordinary classical theory that are resolved or somehow accommodated in the context of the full quantum theory, such as string theory. There are specific examples known of geometries in general relativity that would look singular, but that in string theory are not. The Big Bang singularity that we know and love is not one such example, but maybe just because we don't understand it yet. So perhaps we can understand this ugly singular point if we understand string theory better, or whatever correct quantum theory of gravity. For that matter, maybe there is something before the singularity, the pre-Big Bang era. There may or may not be a pre-Big Bang era, but it's possible that the early universe, if you resolve singularity, there was something that came before that. Maybe the universe was contracting before that. Maybe it was bouncing baby brains or something like that. Nobody really knows, although that hasn't stopped people from proposing ideas. That's what we get paid to do, so we had to do that. So, obviously, we would think that string theory would be useful, not just in that era, but in getting from that era to our box. Okay, what's next? We can move sideways. The universe we observe looks homogeneous and isotropic and pretty much the same everywhere. That is no reason to conclude that it is the same everywhere. So what about the ultra-large-scale structure of space? In fact, there's reason to believe the opposite. If you believe in inflation, inflation might end in some places and not end in other places. So you might have regions out here that are still inflating. You might even have regions out here that have stopped inflating but have ended in a different one of these disconnected vacua up here. That means that the universe might actually physically realize a very large number of very different vacuum-like states at different parts of the universe, in which case things that you might have thought were questions about the fundamental laws or parameters of physics become questions about our environment that we happen to be seeing. We happen to live in this box. There might be another box where things look very different. So that changes the nature of the kinds of questions you can ask and the kind of answers you might expect to get.
Do you get any predictable statement by studying the region code?
You might, yes.
Even though it's outside of your life.
Well, you know, what you need to do is to have a theory that predicts everything inside and outside your light cone, and then ask what that theory predicts for your inside your light cone.
And in fact, there is another thing which is often missed. One of the goals of the theory is to predict something, and another goal of the theory is to explain something. So the theory which has many vacuum states explains much more than the theory which has only one.
You see why we need a whole program to do this, because there's a lot of good ideas here, and you can argue back and forth. So I said it was sad that there's not one vacuum state to string theory that looks like our world. You could take the opposite point of view, that there's nothing sad or happy about how the universe is. It's the universe, and we need to deal with it. And it might be more explanatory.
If you live in a box, usually you know that something different is out there. If you see some inconsistencies within the box that you cannot resolve. Mm-hmm. So you didn't so far pointed out any inconsistency that we cannot resolve beside this one. And when I asked you about the entropy, you said that it is taken care of. You didn't mention if there is exchange of entropy.
No, I did not say it was taken care of. I said it's a complete mystery. You said it was taken care of.
You said that it's understood.
That's right.
So what is... Can you give an example of some major inconsistency that tells you that maybe there are other boxes outside our box?
Strictly speaking, I don't think so. It's certainly conceivable to me, given everything that we know, that 100 years from now, when we not only know but also understand, the box and obvious extrapolations of the box will be all there is. That's possible.
But then why do you have to assume that the boxes outside are different from the box you're living in?
Because it might be true. I don't know. So I'm trying to understand which... I'm trying to understand. I don't have a theory that explains the whole picture yet. So different extrapolations of what I do understand may or may not lead to very different conditions outside the box. And that's what I would like to understand, the space of possibilities.
Even before you get to chaotic inflation and very speculative things, the fact that inflation works and tells... I mean, the fact that we're in a universe which is so smooth, which is smooth to one part in 10 to the fifth, suggests that we're a tiny patch in a much... larger universe. I mean, that's why our patch is so homogeneous, because it begins, I mean, right, that's what inflation is, right? The whole universe is rather homogeneous, you know?
This is very charming. I mean, it doesn't really, it doesn't really suggest anything to me. Yeah, I mean...
quantitative question, which is the following.
Yes.
If you do use inflation to solve the problems of homogeneity and so on, is there any minimal size to our universe, or really could it be just larger than what we see?
It could be just larger than what we see, but I would think that if you told me I lived in a box that is this big and everywhere in that I lived somewhere and I could only observe part of it and everywhere I observed it looked exactly the same, I would have thought the minimal extrapolation was that it looked everywhere the same. That's what I would have thought was the most obvious extrapolation. Now, it could also be that so given inflation, given what we know about inflation, what you're pointing out is inflation makes it very natural that what you see is not what you get. That we have a tiny part of the universe which has been hugely expanded to look very smooth and so forth, and that is completely disconnected from what is happening very, very far away. Given what we know about inflation, I think that that is a natural possibility that we should consider, but I don't want to say anything about what is actually more or less likely.
Are there people still talking about the periodic universe idea?
Yes.
They're
still talking about it. So this box, our universe might even be smaller than this box, but it's repetitive, so this part of the box is actually the same as that part of the box. However, if that's true, that better be almost as big as the box, or we would have noticed it already.
There is one hint coming from the paper, sorry. Is that delta rho rho, this density perturbation, grow at large distances in almost all reasonable inflationary theories. So at very large distances, if there is no special cut in the universe, this delta rho rho should be larger than one, which means that the universe becomes fractal at large distances.
Yes, that's
so
right.
That's quite a hint.
Yeah, I mean, okay, that's... I actually think it's very unlikely that out here the universe looks exactly the same as inside the box. But I don't want to say that out loud because I might be wrong, and I have no... It's... All of this is within the context of our current rather amorphous ideas. I don't want to put too much faith in that. Okay. Oh, look, there's another direction which we haven't talked about. The future of the universe. We're being taken over these days by the dark energy, because it is not going away as fast as the matter is, which is going away. It used to be very small, so I really should include what we understand to not have gotten quite as far as our current universe, because the dark energy is something we certainly don't understand. The difference between dark matter and dark energy is that dark energy is smoothly distributed through space and time, and dark matter clumps and dissipates, and so forth. So if the universe expands by a factor of 2 in linear size, the amount of dark energy in that co-moving box is 8 times bigger than it used to be, because the energy density is constant and the volume went up by a factor of 8. Dark matter, the energy density in dark matter is the same in that box, because it's the number of particles times their mass. And both of those stayed constant.
The equation of state is same?
No. Very different. The equation of state is very different. That's a good way of putting it, yes. The equation of state for dark energy is that P, the pressure, equals minus the energy density. It has a tension, which is why dark energy is a bad thing to call it. What you should call it is smooth tension, which is both more accurate and sexier name for the dark energy. It's the same everywhere, and it's a negative pressure. That's the point of the dark energy. So the dark energy and the destiny of the universe. So what this means is, why do we have dark energy? Why do we have the amount that we have? What is it, and what will happen to it in the future? Why don't we have a lot more? Why do we have approximately the same amount of matter? Will it last forever, or will we in fact decay into some supersymmetric vacuum very, very far in the future? All of those are interesting questions, which certainly string theory has something to say about, or should. And finally, there is, you know, into the board. I guess you draw that this way, something like that? Is that an arrow drawn into the board?
It's coming out
of the board. It doesn't matter. The secret is the box is really a cylinder because, of course, the universe is the same in every direction. So in and out are the same. But number 6. So what I mean by this is the possibility that even right here, right now, there still lurk these extra dimensions of space that are predicted by string theory. They might be affecting us right now. They might be affecting us in profound ways in the sense of affecting the vacuum energy and the cosmological constant. They might have something to do with dark matter. They might show up at Fermilab tomorrow in a preprint, which you haven't read yet. They might be big enough to detect in some ground-based experiment or something like that. So in the box, but in some direction orthogonal to all three of the directions that you grew up in, there could be things going on. So, okay, that's it. I haven't given you any answers. I've asked a bunch of questions. We know a lot about the universe from actual cosmological observations. I should point out that, not including this stuff, a lot of this was really firmed up only in the last 10 years in terms of our knowledge of cosmology. 10 years ago, cosmologists were all very depressed. They've been asking the same questions for most of the century, and they hadn't really had any confidence they were going to answer those questions. And they both answered the questions, invented more questions, answered them, and are starting to answer yet a new set of questions about what the universe is really like. Why it is that way remains a mystery, and in all of these different kinds of things that we don't understand, I think that string theory, in principle, has something to say. So we need to understand how to connect these ideas of string theory, brains, extra dimensions, supersymmetric vacua, non-supersymmetric vacua, to where the universe came from, what it looks like very far away, and where it might go. Thank you.
Any more questions, especially from non?
I didn't say that I represent others. I didn't ask any question. From statistical physics, simple statistical physics point of view, you talk about the superstrings, and when you started, you talked about energy modes and vibrations and so on, that we could even recognize the terminology. But if we want to understand the entropy of a system, we want to understand how these degrees of freedom are introduced when one wants to calculate the entropy. And it seems that this is an essential question, just naively asking, that if the universe is expanding or not expanding, the phase space is shrinking because it has dissipation, higher entropy law, and you didn't refer how this vibration, different type of modes, associated with the number of states for calculating the entropy.
Right.
That's one question, and the connected question is, you mentioned the dark energy, that you said that it's distributed homogeneously. I didn't understand if it's known in terms of the current understanding from superstring or models, or is it known independently? And is there an exchange of entropy between the ordinary matter and the ordinary dark matter and this dark energy?
Okay, so good. I actually know the answer to some small fraction of those questions that you just asked. The first question about the entropy, I just don't know the answer to. I think that different people in this room think that they have a very good idea of what the answer is. And so I'm not one of them. So you have a universe that is expanding. It gets bigger, that much we're happy with. The number of degrees of freedom inside that box increase, or did you just turn on, excite some pre-existing degrees of freedom that were turned off? I don't even know the answer to that question, much less, you know, why the entropy is a certain way or not. So I'm very agnostic about that. I think that's worth thinking about. There are ideas that we have that certainly bear on it, like the idea of inflation being able to take a Planck scale size smooth patch and blow it up to the size of our universe. That's very suggestive that you might explain the apparent arrow of time in that way.
So the inflationary level, it's like a micro-canonical example that all the degrees of freedom, all the universes, everything are sort of equal probability?
Not equal probability, but in their vacuum state originally is what it means. So, I mean, if you take a galaxy today and just take its the size of the universe that it corresponds to and shrink it along with the shrinking universe, if you go into the past, that entire galaxy at the end of inflation, the beginning of inflation, I should say, was much smaller than the Planck scale. Now, what does that mean? I think I don't know.
Sean?
Well, I'm not done asking. He asked another question. So let me finish that. The question I know the answer to is why, what about the dark energy? How do we know that it's smoothly distributed? And the answer is empirically, we know. Given that there's something that makes the universe accelerate, see, the point is the dark energy doesn't go away as the universe expands. So according to this equation, h squared is proportional to rho. Rho is a constant in dark energy. H is a constant. V equals h times d. So if you look at a given galaxy, h is a constant, d is increasing. So you see its velocity increase as a function of time. That's a telltale sign. Because if it was just matter, rho would be diminishing, h would be diminishing, and you would see it decelerate. So the simplest thing we know that doesn't go away is a vacuum energy that remains perfectly constant. But then you test that hypothesis. You look at the cosmic microwave background, you look at fluctuations of galaxies and so forth, and fits perfectly. So there then are upper limits on how much fluctuation you can have. That's the answer to that question, I think. Yes?
John, you've given the new party line.
I have.
Party line, sometimes they change. So what we observe is, in fact, a limited subset of the things that we think to be the new party line, namely we see ordinary matter, we see photons, we don't see dark matter in the sense of, you know, we see our extrapolation of measurements that we then interpret as dark matter, say dark energy. Is it possible that we're misinterpreting the data that we do have and extrapolating something?
Right. So the question is, I mean, if to a working astronomer, if you're not a working astronomer and you play a working astronomer for a summer or something like that, you realize, my God, these people extrapolate these incredibly complicated stories on the basis of just a couple of photons, really. And we're doing that with the whole universe. I mean, it's a very small amount of things we've actually directly observed. And I'm supposed to tell you that I know that only 5% of the universe is ordinary matter and 20% is dark matter, dark energy, stuff like that. How much confidence do we have that we haven't just missed something big and there's some paradigm shift lurking in the background? Well, I don't know how to quantify the answer, obviously. What I do know how to do is to say, well, let's deviate from this idea. Let's try to modify it a little bit. And do we find a whole family of alternative possibilities that fit just as well, or do we crash and burn immediately? Almost always, we crash and burn immediately. So for example, I could write down a model where there's dark energy that interacts with dark matter. Just a small interaction. We've never observed either one of them directly. How harmful could that be? The answer is it totally screws up the microwave background. It totally screws up large-scale structure and things like that. You go wrong very quickly. I can come up with a model, and I'm not really speaking hypothetically here in any of these cases, where instead of dark energy, you modify Einstein's equation, right? You say, well, I haven't observed dark energy, just general relativity breaks down. All sorts of hell breaks loose. I mean, you have solar system tests, the binary pulsar, and things like that that are tests of general relativity. So this is a very minimal model, given the observations. This is the simplest thing you could write down. It fits perfectly. When you try to come up with something more complicated, or even something that is temporarily more complicated because it hopefully reflects some underlying more beautiful thing, you run into problems very quickly. So the moral of the story, I think, is that we actually, even though we don't have nearly as rich a set of observations as we would like, the set of observations we already have are incredibly constraining on what we can do. And therefore, I'm going to bet against some major paradigm shift in the near future.
Okay, on that confident
prediction. Yes. Thank you.